welcome to Indie Darlings, the podcast where we discuss films that we consider to be indie darlings. Granted, this can be for good or bad reasons. It's, you know, because indie films have a much wider criteria. Now, for this film, for this podcast episode, we're going to be discussing the film Happiness, the 1998 film by Todd Solondz. And our guest for today is Zed Kutzinger.
Hey.
Now, I'm Zed. I'm just going to give a quick summary of the film Happiness based on Google. This dark ensemble comedy is centered on three Jordan sisters. Joy, played by Jane Addams, moves through lackluster jobs with no sense of purpose. Now employed teaching adults, she is dating a student Russian taxi driver, Vlad. Helen, played by Laura Flynn Boyle, is an esteemed poet who becomes amused by her pervert neighbor, Alan, played by Philip Seymour Hoffman. And eldest sister Trish, played by Cynthia Stevenson, is married to Bill Dylan Baker, a psychiatrist with a very disturbing secret life. Okay. Now that's the summary of this film. I offered a list of indie films to Zed to choose from, and he chose Happiness off that list. Zed, why did you choose this film?
Happiness is a movie I hadn't seen in a while. I remembered loving it, but I think it's important to revisit movies that you love to either realize that it doesn't hold up anymore for whatever reason, or in this case for me with this movie, I found more reasons to like it. Mm. And I am so happy that I rewatched it for this.
Yeah, I feel the same way. I also had seen this already, and part of me was like, I should probably just watch it as a refresher. Mm-hmm. And I'm so glad I did. Rewatching it, there's so much stuff I noticed that I didn't notice before.
Yeah.
And this film just pops. Like, I don't know how many Todd Solondz films you've seen. I've seen almost all of them.
Okay.
And there's a thing where once it starts, it holds your attention.
Yeah.
And this is no exception. What did you know about this film before you saw it?
So prior to seeing this, either the first time or this, I'd seen Welcome to the Dollhouse. Mm-hmm. And I knew that just this movie was very, I don't want to say like edgy, but I just knew that it was a movie that's people recommend when they're like, do you want to watch a movie that's hard to watch?
Yeah. Welcome to the Dollhouse is Todd Solondz's breakout film. And that itself is probably the most audience safe film he has. And even mm-hmm. then it's dark. Like there's a love story in it that starts between a bully and the main character, who's this awkward girl and named Daniel Wiener. And one of their first interactions, he says, I'm going to rape you.
Yeah.
And that later turns into like a genuine relationship, which is so insane. But his films seem to have gotten darker from there.
Yeah.
And here's some fun facts I found about the film. Okay. Well, a running theme in a lot of Todd Solondz films is pedophilia.
Okay.
Well, you saw Welcome to the Dollhouse?
Yeah, and Life During Wartime.
Life During Wartime, which is pretty much the sequel to this.
Yeah.
Although the entire cast is replaced with different actors.
Yeah.
Which is very jarring and makes you very aware of people's names.
Yes.
And what's so interesting is he didn't just replace the entire cast. He replaced the entire cast with established actors.
Yes.
Like, because this film has established actors, but the next film has also established actors.
Yeah, I mean, it's, I think, trying to play with, beyond all the themes that he's doing in his movies, using different actors to play the same parts, it aids to this feel where his movies kind of feel like plays
in a
weird way. And, you know, how many times has a play happened with the same actors? You know, they're constantly shifting and recasting. So I think doing that in a film is not only unique because we get so attached to the character or to the actor playing the character. So I think playing with that is just such an interesting thing to do, and something specifically going into this idea of indie darlings in the genre of indie, you couldn't do that with a major.
Yeah.
A studio would be like, no, you need to keep the same
yeah,
people.
Yeah, it's going to, the audience is too connected to the actors.
Yeah, it's but not marketable.
I feel like Todd Solondz really likes to push that to the extreme because he has another film called Palindromes where this the main character is played by seven different actors.
Okay.
It's a young teenage girl played by actors of various race, age, and one time a boy. And it's incredible. Like, it's the movie's divided into chapters, and it'll be like Huckle, Andrew, because the main character's name is Ava.
Okay.
No, Aviva, because her name's a palindrome. And the purpose of the different actors, he said, was to show, like, sometimes, because every time her story changes, the actor changes.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, because she's like, sometimes you feel awkward and out of place. Sometimes you feel virginal. Sometimes you feel like a little kid. Sometimes you feel like a little Huckleberry boy.
It's funny how that's almost like the inverse of Cloud Atlas, where they have the same actor playing different characters throughout time to show, I guess, how intrinsically people can be connected through timelines and, you know, like this idea of a soul or spirit. And I think their way of showing that was by using the same actor or actress. But I like that this is the kind of the inverse to show the changes in a character changing the actor or actress.
I mean, I do feel like Todd makes a very interesting point in showing that, like, how well the audience, he trusts the audience to know this character and their characteristics, because that all the actors, they speak in a very specific way that the character has.
Like a cadence and rhythm almost.
Yes, yes. Oh. Who is the name of that actress who is in The Hateful Eight?
Oh, Jennifer Jason Leigh.
She plays one of the Avivas.
Oh, really?
It's intense because she's dressed like a little girl at a party, and she's taking on the cadence of that shy, awkward, chubby teen. And it's so surreal seeing this grown woman and an established actress play that part.
That's very cool. Mm-hmm. It also makes sense why Todd Solondz, even though he has like this cult following, knowing all these choices, why
I can understand why people would be like, I could understand why a lot of all these actors like, I got to be in this movie.
Yes.
Okay. How was it? There's a lot of fun facts about this movie. This is John Lovitz's first credited film.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's crazy.
According to IMDb. Because right off the bat, I can think of a bunch of other films that he was in. Because I know he was in A League of Our Own.
Yeah. And I mean, he had what was it? The Great, or is it The Amazing Race? Whatever that, The Rat Race?
Rat Race came, this was 1998.
It was
Rat
after
Race
that.
Came after. But he was also in that movie with Nicolas Cage and Dana Carvey where they play robbers.
Oh yeah,
I remember loving that film.
Yeah, it like takes place like in Nebraska or something.
Yeah, they're all brothers, but they're also robbers. And there's a part where they're holding up a bank, and John Lovitz is basically teaching everyone yoga to calm them down as they hold it up.
Which is, he was just such a, I didn't realize this.
This might be wrong.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, sometimes I feel like the trivia, it's like Wikipedia, anyone can add to it. But it was just interesting to see him in this because leading up to this, I don't know what movies he was in particular, but he was such a big part of like SNL and he was such a comedic actor.
Yeah.
It was just cool to see him play such a dramatic scene.
Was Paul Rubens in this?
He was in Life During Wartime.
Oh, yeah. Okay. But he plays the character that John Lovitz is playing.
Oh, yeah, because it's the ghost.
The ghost of
Yeah, yeah, because he, spoiler alert.
I think it's so interesting that Todd Solondz takes actors that are known for doing comedy and putting them in the darkest role possible.
Yeah.
Like, the character that John Lovitz plays is a jilted lover who is getting broken up with in the very beginning of the film and reacts in the worst way possible and ultimately commits suicide.
Yeah.
And it gets darker and darker and darker from there.
Yeah, it's interesting. When I saw this when I was younger, that opening scene in his perspective, I guess I was a bit more angsty. I was a little bit like, man, that's so cool that, you know, he told her what was up.
Mm-hmm.
But now in this rewatch, I'm much more aware of, I'm like, oh, he, like, I feel more for Joy.
Yeah.
Her, and more like, he's kind of a dick.
Yeah.
And also his character coupled with Philip Seymour Hoffman, I guess it's becoming more zeitgeisty right now, but this whole idea of like the incel movement, I guess men who consider themselves involuntarily celibate.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, oh, this kind of seems like the blueprint of these kind of characters.
Yeah.
Like how Philip Seymour Hoffman is, you know, he's in love with this next door neighbor that because she's so hot. And then you have the other woman who's maybe unattractive, but he feels like he deserves the hotter woman.
Yeah.
And also John Lovitz, instead of kind of being like, oh, maybe I'm not the right guy for you. Like, we don't see her being manipulative and being terrible to him by any capacity.
No, she's being honest and she's just breaking up because she's not in love with this guy.
And he has like his little fit where I'm like, oh, this feels like all those men that feel owed.
He has like a full on tantrum. Like after she breaks up with him, he hands her an ashtray that's been engraved that says her name on it.
Yeah.
And he's like, but that's not for you. It's not for you fucking bitch.
Yeah.
And it's so insane and childish. And yeah, but it also makes sense because later when he commits suicide, his mother calls her being like, I hope you're happy, you fucking bitch. And I'm like, oh, that's where it came from.
Yeah. I feel like the one thing I do want to kind of compliment his character, because it does seem like he's bad for many reasons. I think it is cool that he had the courage to kill himself.
Yeah.
Rather than a bunch of women.
Yeah. What was funny is like afterwards when, because he was a coworker of hers, and she find she's crying at work, and the other coworkers find out, and they're like, "Who was this guy?" Like
that scene was so funny.
That was so fucking Molly Shannon's in that scene,
yeah.
And she does it so well. But there's like four people talking, all trying to guess who this guy is.
Yeah, that's the thing that's very interesting to me about this movie is like, you know, through UCB training and learning about, you know, scenes having a specific game or, you know, whatever the comedic thing is. This movie, even if you're not into the acting and, you know, all the great choices the director's making, if you're just watching this as a comedy, there are so many scenes that are just so funny.
Absolutely.
And I guess you have to kind of surrender yourself to how fucked up the subject matter is.
Yeah, I feel like you do have to watch it twice because you need to give yourself a second to get over the shock value. Because there's scenes between... Okay, so spoiler, there's a character in this film that is a pedophile. And this character is married with kids. And he has a son who's starting puberty. And the son's talking to him in a very real way about why he's never ejaculated.
Mm-hmm.
Is his body normal? And the father's talking to him and he's giving him practical advice, but it's also going, knowing what you know about him.
Yeah.
You sense the beginning of grooming.
Yeah.
And it's so awful, but there's moments that are comedic in it.
I couldn't tell if when the son is asking his dad about if he would have sex with him and the dad goes, he's like, no, I wouldn't have sex with you. He's like, I would just jerk off. And he's like crying.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't tell.
I was going to ask you, what did you think that was about?
I can't tell if the son was like almost
disappointed,
like, offended that he wasn't like worthy enough to his father to be. It reminds me of there was this British show Brass Eye by Chris Morris, which is like one of the funniest but also most fucked up shows.
Yeah.
Where there's an episode about pedophilia and Chris Morris has what's his name, the British actor who's in all the Edgar Wright movies, can't think of his name, but whatever, he's in it and he's playing a pedophile, and Chris Morris has his son, and he's like, and the pedophile is in one of those like ancient medieval devices, you know, where his hands are through the little slots and his neck is through it, where they like throw stuff at
them. I think it's called the stocks or something.
Yeah. And he's like, oh, he's like, you know, my son is right here, and if you weren't locked up, you would try to like rape my son. And then it's Simon Pegg, I think, goes, no, I wouldn't. And he's like, what do you mean you wouldn't? He's like, I don't really fancy your son. And then Chris Morris gets very offended. He's like, but you're a pedophile. And he's like, yeah, I don't think your son is that attractive. So it's like a very funny scene where he gets like offended that the pedophile doesn't want to sleep with his son.
Yeah.
But regardless, this scene, there's something comedic about that.
Yeah.
And him trying to impress his father. And when he finds that out, it's like, it's so fucked up.
Yeah.
But you do kind of his perspective, the son, you're like, I can see how he feels.
Like, what's wrong with me?
Yeah, exactly.
Because he just found out that his, spoiler alert, there's his dad drugged and raped not one but two boys in his class.
Yeah,
like one was during a sleepover at the boy's house, and you know, it's so strange because you see the dad pouring pills into sundaes that he's making for his family,
yeah,
to knock him out, and then of course his target doesn't like chocolate, which is on the sundae, and so he's desperately trying to figure out the best way to knock this kid out.
Yeah.
And I remember when this, because this is the second time I saw this, I'm like, I'm confused at how I feel right now.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, I should be thinking this, oh, thank God the boy's going to escape. But at the same time, I'm looking at the character being like, the dad being like, think of something.
Yeah, I mean, it's very analogous to like a classic comedic scene where, I mean, I almost want to say like Bugs Bunny or something, where they set up a trap and you see them almost do the trap and then not do it.
Yes.
And they keep kind of like flirting with it, and you're like, you know, then something, yeah, the anvil doesn't fall on their head. And this scene is like that, but the stakes are just so much more real and dark because it is based around molestation and, you know, everything that's wrong.
Yeah.
And so on one hand, you obviously don't want him to do it.
Yeah.
But the father,
you feel the frustration.
Yeah. There's like a frustration that's very visible
because he makes him like a tuna sandwich after listing a bunch of foods he could tempt the boy with. And then he makes the tuna sandwich for him. And he checks on the boy, and sure enough, the tuna sandwich is just sitting there. And the boy's like, can I eat this tomorrow? And the dad's like racking his fucking brain.
So disappointed. I mean, he like wants to go to the store to get grape flavored high C. And yeah, the mom's like,
yeah,
you
it's
don't
like,
need to.
What's like,
to the
what's
store.
Wrong with you?
Yeah.
He's fine. Leave him alone.
So, yeah. I understand why maybe this isn't funny to people. But if you can surrender yourself, these are fictional people. Whatever, it's a movie, and you can just kind of laugh, mm-hmm, at the tension and just, yeah, the way they're able to build it. It's a very funny movie.
Oh God, okay. This stood out to me. I just remembered, I didn't notice it the first time I saw it, but the second time I was like, ooh, that struck a nerve with me. There's a line where, okay, so he's the son is telling the dad, the pedophile, that he's asking, how come I can't stay home alone? A friend in my class is staying home alone without a babysitter. And he's like, no. And then he's like, well, what about when I'm 13? And the dad is pensive for a moment and goes, as long as you don't look 13, as long as you don't look 11, you'll be fine.
Yeah, I mean, because then a pedophile won't try to sleep with you, I guess, right?
That shook me to my core.
I mean, it's interesting how his character, he is very... like, it feels like a very realistic depiction of like a pedophile, but I feel like the movie does a good job of showing him and demonizing him.
Yeah.
But not, I never really felt for him. You know what I mean?
Well, here's the thing. In hindsight, I did feel for him because his character is introduced by showing a dream that he has where he enters. This is a kind of an iconic scene. He enters a park. It's whenever you run into those internet lists of like top 10 fucked up scenes from a movie, this is always on it. So, okay, Todd Solondz is known for having ironically happy music in his movies. So it's really cheerful music's playing. You see a really green park, and then someone enters and he pulls out an AK and starts shooting at random people. And then you see that the guy who shot up the scene is like, what do you think my dream means, doctor?
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, God.
And then he goes, he's like, and the difference this time is that he didn't kill himself at the end, right?
Yeah. Oh, I know. Oh, my God. I know what the dream means now. Okay. So he has a dream where he goes into a park and he shoots up everybody and then ends with him killing himself. Okay. But this time he didn't. okay, so this guy is obviously crawling with demons that is making him hate himself. And, but the thing is, he hasn't acted on them. And this time, he's finally like, fuck it.
Yeah.
And so that's when he starts attacking kids. Because this is all stuff he's thought about.
Yeah.
But this time, he's doing it.
Yeah. It's also, I mean, there's also this whole like other layer to the scene that's very funny because he is a therapist himself and he's speaking to another therapist.
Yeah.
Where I'm just imagining being in the shoes of the other therapist, just being like, I can't believe this guy is a therapist.
Yeah, being like, I don't know, man. I don't know. This is just one of a couple of stories happening in this movie.
Yeah. Which is interesting because I feel like the 90s there were, I don't know why, but I guess going more into recommendations later, but you know, you had like Magnolia, you had American Beauty, and then after this you had Crash. It was this like weird thing where they had these big ensembles where everyone is like loosely connected.
Yeah.
And this, I think, fits into that, but is by far the best out of any of them.
Yeah. Well, cause you see why they're connected and, well, for the most part, they're connected because they're all one big family.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember watching this, and because there's other stories, it's a big family. There's three sisters who all are all grown up, and then it shows their parents' lives. And I remember thinking, because you follow the parents have a story where they're getting separated because the dad just wants to live alone.
Yeah,
And I remember when we were following his story, because there's a woman at the senior center who really wants him.
Yeah.
Like a saucy older woman who's like, I don't want to die alone. And I remember thinking, why is this part of the movie? But then I'm like, oh, because like the dad, he doesn't want to be with his wife anymore, but he doesn't really know what he wants.
Yeah.
It's a weird like existential crisis that ends with him ultimately adding salt to his food.
Yeah, because the doctor tells him what he's like. You can live 35 more years. Just don't. He's like, lay off the salt.
Yeah,
and I think ultimately he's like, I don't understand the purpose of my life.
Yeah,
and so that we see him put the salt on it.
Yeah,
it's also that final scene where just everyone's together, which is just interesting. It's like, oh, this is the scene where everybody meets at least the family. There were like two very specific things in it that I never would have noticed before, but I'm like, oh, I think this is like commentary on the entire movie leading up to it.
Yeah.
Which was when Joy is not laughing and the sister starts laughing and she goes, oh, I'm laughing with you, not at you.
Yeah.
I was like, okay, I think that is Todd kind of speaking to the audience where he's like, this entire movie, you have been laughing at all these characters.
Yeah.
And he's like, I guess, but from your perspective, you feel like you're laughing with them. And this is them very much going, oh no, none of this is funny to us.
Yeah. This is our hell.
Yeah.
And you have been laughing.
And then the other small one, which was very interesting to me, is they're talking about the neighbor who chopped up Pedro,
played by Cameron Manheim,
and put him in zip they call them baggies, and they're all like, oh yeah, this story is very relatable because of the baggies. I'm like, this is interesting where this entire movie is, there's nothing relatable about it except kind of just like the film around, like the premise.
Yeah.
And I'm like, this whole movie is there's nothing relatable about it in the specifics of what happened, murdering someone, but the fact that they use baggies, I'm like, this movie is relatable just because we can kind of see the fringe, just kind of the exterior of the scenes. And we're like, oh yeah, I have a sister.
Yeah.
And so I was like, oh, that's interesting. Just the way it kind of packed it up at the end where it's like, yeah, we understand that there's nothing relatable about this movie, but you did get pulled in because of the baggies.
Yeah.
And I think that was like very purposeful.
Mm-hmm.
Something I never would have noticed on my first viewing.
I remember, there's amazing performances in this film, but I feel like I appreciate the characters a lot more this time, because I remember when I first saw it, I didn't like Laura Flynn Boyle's character. I feel like I didn't fully, because she plays the poet, and she's always like humble bragging, being like, I'm so sick of being admired, everyone around me shallow. But then, like, and she's like angsty about it. But this time around, I was weirdly like, Yeah, that does kind of suck, actually.
Well, except when she makes her big monologue about how she wishes she had been raped.
Well, here's the thing. I'm not like, I'm not feeling for that, but feel like she's the most successful out of all of her sisters. Her life sounds like a dream, but the thing is, like, her life still feels empty. And I'm like, yeah, that does suck. And it leaves me wondering, like, is the other sister, the one with the husband and the kids, who thinks that she has it all? I'm wondering, is she the only happy one, or is she also secretly unhappy like the rest of them? Because the thing with her is, she, out of all of her sisters, she has the most reasons to be unhappy.
Yeah.
But the fact that she, well, she's also, there's a running joke. Two different characters say this to her. Oh, everyone knows.
Yeah.
Because she's, I guess she's just never in the know.
Yeah. And
is that why she's happy?
I guess ignorance is bliss kind of thing. I mean, because she was married to a man that was like, had all these like pedophilic like fantasies and stuff. Yeah. And she just never was aware of it. So she was happy.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, the movie's called Happiness, but ironically, the woman named Joy is probably,
she has the saddest.
Yeah,
one.
The saddest.
And she also sings a titular song, yeah, which I still don't know how I feel about.
Well, it's so interesting how just speaking of that song, it makes me think of when Vlad sings that song, which was when she like meets him, and the song lyrically is almost like perfectly written for that moment.
Mm-hmm.
When he's like, your music will save me. It's like, oh, it seems like it was written about her.
Mm-hmm.
And then oddly enough, there's the scene where that sister who was like depraved of, like, her life was, as you were saying, like, so hollow, as she's like making this big speech, that's right when Philip Seymour, she's like, I'm a zero, I'm nothing. And then he calls her and he's like, you're a zero, you're nothing.
Mm-hmm.
The movie does this interesting thing where characters speak to one another, where it's just like perfect puzzle pieces, but they couldn't have known what was happening.
Yeah.
And it's like this like higher being who just kind of like puts these two things together. So
yeah,
I thought that was very interesting.
I like, well, the thing I liked about this movie is that there's the characters in it are all struggling to find happiness, but Todd Solondz does a great job of showing that it's not just because of their circumstances.
Oh, like it's also the choices they're making.
Yeah. And who they are as people.
Yeah.
Okay. So Philip Seymour Hoffman plays a guy who has an issue where he likes to go through the phone book randomly and call up women and just, how would you describe this? Like,
I guess verbally assault them.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, be like, what are you wearing? And just jerking off into the phone. And he does this to Laura Flynn Boyle, and Laura Flynn Boyle is like intrigued, and she's like, come over. And so he does. And they sit on their couch in silence. And it's, I'm like, yeah, well, you're not going to do anything.
Yeah, I mean, he's the guy who, again, like, I feel like his, it's interesting how in the 90s, there wasn't, you know, like the idea of men's rights activists, incel, all these things are newer, but these kind of feel like the blueprint of these kind of characters.
Mm-hmm.
Where I see these guys on, you know, Reddit talking about all these things they would do with women and mm-hmm. stuff, and then they meet a woman and they can't speak to her.
You're going to sit there in silence.
And also, oddly enough, the other movie that came out around the same time, Magnolia, you mm-hmm. have like Tom Cruise's character
yeah.
who's almost wrangling these men.
Yeah.
And the funny thing is, these men, like, they existed back then,
uh-huh.
obviously, but without the internet, they weren't able to create a community.
Yeah. I also do this weird shit.
Yeah. And like almost like, not accept, but almost like, make it okay for one another,
mm-hmm.
and then to the point where then they, you know, get in their car and they drive through a bunch of women. It's just interesting that these, when we have a problem that's existing now, you look at media back in the 90s and you're like, oh, it was there. It just didn't culminate until yeah. more recently.
Yeah. It's, Philip Seymour Hoffman, he does such a great job playing this awful character. And it's so interesting because he's given the opportunity with Laura Flynn Boyle, and he's given the opportunity with Cameron Manheim, who's clearly into him. Like, she literally walks up to his apartment saying, I have these two tickets to the playoffs. And he's just like, I'm good. And it's so fucking sad because you see her sadly walk down the hall, ripping up the tickets.
Yeah.
That you knew she bought just to ask him out. And it is just like you're literally throwing women at this man who's just like, no, thank you.
Yeah. And then also like when he finally, in terms of his like character arc, is like with her. Mm-hmm. And it seems like they're having this romantic thing. Yeah. She's like, oh, I never want to have sex.
Yeah.
To the character that is so horny.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, well, okay. But then when they're in bed together mm-hmm. and they're sleeping, it's like, is this happiness?
Yeah, because there's a part where he answers the door and he's like about to black out drunk and he collapses on his bed and Cameron Manheim just gets in bed with him and spoons with him.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, okay, this is what she wants. But then I guess she wants the tenderness of a relationship, but not actual intercourse.
Yeah, which is, I mean, that's fine.
Which is fucking tragic because her character gets raped.
Yes. And also, like, there's the marriage that, it's so funny how they keep saying it's not a divorce.
Yeah.
But regardless, it's like the woman would rather be in the marriage that is dysfunctional and loveless mm-hmm. than to be on her own.
Yeah.
Like, it's like you find happiness being in this relationship that isn't working mm-hmm. rather than being, you know what I mean? Like, there's something very interesting about that.
Yeah. Like, when the wife finds out that her husband is moving out, like... She instantly is already knows of this woman that's like into him.
Oh, because she's driving and kind of gives her the bad look.
Yeah. And she like fantasizes about driving her, running her over. Yeah. And for a second, you think she's about to. And like she already knows that this other woman's interested in her husband. Her husband might be interested back. Her husband doesn't want to be there. But for some reason, she desperately doesn't want to lose that situation.
Yeah, I feel like there's a lot of, it's like these weird setups, but there's like stifled results, but almost like in the inverse.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for instance, with the Russian guy where it's like, oh, there's like some hope here.
Mm-hmm.
And then she finds out that he like beats this woman and it's just like.
He lives in this chaotic household and he's a swindler. He literally steals from her apartment.
I mean, he said his occupation before was a thief.
Yeah.
I just could not believe, I mean, kind of what you said at the beginning, it's just interesting how every single scene in this movie, there's something about it that is so memorable
mm-hmm.
where you could, I mean, everything about this movie works in the greater, I guess, capacity of all the scenes together, which, mm-hmm. you know, that piece, but if you isolate any given scene in this and you just watch it, mm-hmm. it's incredible.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which seems like it's either one or the other in most cases, but this mm-hmm. somehow is able to pull both off.
Yeah, I feel like Todd Solondz is very good at creating stories that serve as vignettes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And also, I feel like people might criticize him. And I think now more in retrospect, this movie has more respect, but people might be like, oh, this movie is made to be so shocking and, you know, with all these things. But what's interesting is rewatching it, when there was that rape scene and all the stuff with molesting,
mm-hmm.
he never shows any of it.
Yeah.
Which there is that director that's like, I want the audience to see it and experience it and, mm-hmm. you know, whatever, like irreversible. But he doesn't do that.
Nope.
And as messed up as thematically and I guess story-wise what happens, he never forces us to watch things that we don't want to watch. Just the lead up to them
mm-hmm.
and the, I guess, the fallout.
Yeah, and the aftermath.
Which you know, thank you for not making us watch. Todd, is Todd going to be listening to this?
Hopefully. Yeah.
Thank you, Todd, for not making us watch.
Okay, so what makes this movie an indie darling?
You know, I was thinking a lot about with major studio movies with bigger budget, there's so much more you can do. So then it's a question of the limitations of indie. What is it you can do with, you know, you have more limitations. And I think what makes this an indie darling is there are so many choices in this, not only in the pacing because it's slow,
mm-hmm.
but also the things thematically that it's dealing with. These are things that a major studio production, I don't think would be able to pull off, or it would be so cheesy.
Yeah.
So I think what makes this an indie darling is all the things it touches on and kind of the caress and the way it's able to deal with it is done in a way where a major can never do it. And no indie, I feel like, since or after has been able to deal with it in the way this has. So this is like the best of a dark comedy dealing with all these specific things.
Yeah, it's definitely like I don't see this being done by a major studio just on content alone, but also just like the level of humanity. I feel like you just don't dig that deep into most characters in most movies, and there's a certain level. Like, he makes the audience wince a lot.
Yes.
And it's just in so many unique ways, too. And then, I guess, yeah, I just, yeah, it's, yeah, story, structure, yeah, everything about it's pretty...
Well, in terms of the wincing too, a lot of these characters, it's like there is a version of this character in another movie,
mm-hmm.
but the way that he kind of humanizes them, but still not making them again, like the father, I feel like we're never that sympathetic to him, but mm-hmm. it also doesn't make him into the villainous pedophile.
Yeah. There's no one is treated unrealistically. I feel like,
yeah.
Which I feel like makes his film so hard to watch.
Yes. And I think the fact that people don't want to watch it is also what makes it an indie darling.
Mm-hmm.
You're watching something that makes you feel so uncomfortable and makes you laugh equally mm-hmm. as much. That is something that it's very hard to pull off.
Yeah. Todd Solondz is one of the few people I feel like can pull off a dark comedy.
Yeah. And it's interesting, too, where you have movies like Deadpool, where there is a lot of like dark humor and jokes.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just a lot of like, not to minimize that movie, but it just feels like a lot of jokes written by someone who loves Hot Topic. It's like a lot of like edgelord, like this is so edgy. Like, yeah. I can't believe he's saying that.
Yeah.
This movie's able to do it, but it doesn't feel like it's written by an angsty 15-year-old.
Yeah. It feels like you're laughing at an authentic moment.
Yeah.
It doesn't really feel like that much of a joke. Okay. So if people loved Happiness or are really interested in it, what movies would you like to recommend for them, Zed?
We kind of touched on it, but Welcome to the Dollhouse and Life During
Wartime.
Wartime, because it's the sequel.
Mm-hmm.
I think both of those are good because you can kind of see what he did prior to this, because as much as I liked Welcome to the Dollhouse, this feels more like his Royal Tenenbaums to his Rushmore,
mm-hmm.
where Welcome to the Dollhouse is much smaller. It's well done, but this is just such a bigger, grandiose movie with a bigger mm-hmm. ensemble.
Yeah.
So it's kind of cool to see how he was able to lead up to it.
Yeah.
And then Life During Wartime, it's interesting just to see these characters, the ones that we maybe don't want to revisit.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, well, we're going to revisit them and let's see how they're...
Would you say that people can't see Life During Wartime without seeing Happiness?
No, but I think there's just a lot more you can get out of it
mm-hmm.
just to see where they've come from, especially the character, the father, to see his development. Also, that guy, it's like so funny. I was just watching that new AMC show, The Horror,
mm-hmm.
and he's like one of the captains on it. I'm like, oh, that's the dad from Life During Wartime. Also,
I know of him as the dad from the show Clueless, but go on.
I think also if you do like exploring characters that are, really, really bad, but you kind of want to understand their perspective. There was this Kevin Bacon movie called Woodsman,
mm-hmm.
where he plays a pedophile character who gets out of jail,
mm-hmm.
and just the whole movie is his struggle of his like desires and him trying to stifle them, him mm-hmm. trying not to act on it.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very, very uncomfortable movie to watch just because this is the person that you hate,
mm-hmm.
and that movie actually does a better job at making the audience kind of empathize for him. So it's very uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. This is the person you'd never want to see their side.
Yeah.
That movie's not funny.
Yeah.
But,
it sounds fun, but
it's a difficult watch. But also sideways too, if you do like dark comedy, and a 90s movie, I think of all of the Coen brothers movies, the most that I think I would recommend to this is Fargo. Another bunch of a cast of characters who are all like bad and doing bad things.
Yeah.
And there is like a comedy in how dark it gets.
Yeah. There's very dark comedic moments. Also just seeing people that I feel like Todd Solondz is a champion of showing people that you wouldn't normally see as a main character in a movie.
Mm-hmm.
people on the fringes of society are people that are painfully ordinary.
Yeah.
Like, I do like how he depicts nerdy characters as authentically as possible, because I feel like movies have shown, and TV shows have shown, nerds as like The Big Bang Theory or Steve Urkel or even Napoleon Dynamite. But I feel like when you show an authentic nerd who is just schlumpy looking, the audience, you could feel the pain of being like, oh man, I wouldn't be nice to this person either. And I Todd brings that authenticity and that, I want to say, borderline disgust to a very real place that I appreciate.
Yeah. I mean, every character in this who is sad is so pathetic. And again, it's kind of like at the end when she says, other, you know, we're laughing with you, we're not laughing at you. I was like, I think we're kind of laughing at them.
Yeah. Here's the thing. Like, it doesn't feel self-indulgent, which is saying a lot for an indie film.
Which is so funny considering the ending, which people criticize directors so much, where it's like, oh, this movie is just the director jerking off in front of, you know, an audience for 2 hours. The ending is the boy finally like coming, where I'm like, I think that's him kind of making that joke.
Yeah.
He's like, this is just one big jerk off.
I was thinking about that ending and I'm like, I don't get why he did it. Because after he ejaculates, he goes to his family, all his aunts and his grandpa, and he goes, I came. And I'm like, what teenage boy would do that?
I guess a teenage boy whose father was molesting other boys, and the way that their frank conversations about sexuality, his father was never like, you shouldn't talk about this with other people.
Mm-hmm.
And he was so comfortable talking about his dad with his sexuality. I guess it would feel analogous, where he goes, this is my family. These are the people I can talk to.
Maybe. I don't know.
Also, I mean, his dad offered to teach him how to jerk off. He's like, do you want to watch me?
That was so upsetting. So upsetting.
It is very silly, the ending, but to me, I'm like, this might be my favorite ending of any movie ever.
I mean, it's definitely, it has Todd Solondz written all over it.
Yeah.
Okay. We're coming towards the end of our program. Zed, is there anything you would like to plug?
I have a movie podcast called Views from the Vista that I host with Steve Hernandez and Honor Nezzo. We see every movie at the Vista and we talk about it. Views from the Vista. And then I think probably by the time this comes out, I have another podcast I started with John Milheiser, very funny, called Radio Shorts. It's just going to be a series of sketches.
Wow.
If you're like me and you grew up listening to those Adam Sandler CDs.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, let's have a podcast of scripted funny things.
That sounds awesome.
We'll see. We'll see. Hopefully
we'll see
it's awesome.
We'll see it be awesome. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay. And that's about it for this episode of Indie Darlings. If you have any hot takes or questions, come at us on Instagram or Twitter at Indie Darlings Podcast. And that is all for today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hey, it's Angela.
Hey, it's Lindsay.
And we host the feminist podcast, Welcome to the Clam Bake.
It's the opposite of a sausage fest.
It's an anatomy joke.
Each week, we talk about the challenges, triumphs, and follies of feminism.
With incredible guests, product reviews, and call-ins from feminist clams like you.
It's an educational party for the soul.
So don't be sexist.
Listen to us every Monday on Campfire Media.
Subscribe on Apple Podcasts.
Or your favorite listening app.
Sometimes I take off my pants.
Campfire.